Case number 13-7044 et al. Benicio Aguasanta Arias, husband, on behalf of himself as guardian of his four minor children and on behalf of all other similarly situated et al. Appellants versus Dying et Court et al. Ms. Levesque for the appellants, Mr. Lasker for the appellees.
Morning.
Good morning. Thank you. May it please the court, Christian Levesque on behalf of the plaintiff's appellants in this case. This appeal involves a question of whether the district court erred when it granted summary judgment against thousands of plaintiffs that were so-called non-test plaintiffs who had never agreed to be bound by the so-called test plaintiffs' summary judgment dispositions. They also never received notice that they could be bound or that summary judgment may be entered against them. It is undisputed that the DynCorp appellees in this case never moved for summary judgment against the non-test plaintiffs. All of their motions, or particularly the motions that are on appeal, were only directed at the test plaintiffs. There were no procedural mechanisms in place. Again, there was no consent. When the district court granted summary judgment against the non-test plaintiffs in this case, the court in essence converted it into a de facto common law class action, again, without those procedural mechanisms like an opt-out.
Would you say excuse me. Well, I was going to ask you about the famous footnote.
The famous footnote number 3?
In which you suggest that the advantage of the district court proceeding along the lines that you wish would be that the test plaintiffs would bind the non-test plaintiffs.
Well, I think that the footnote 3 doesn't actually say that. Footnote 3 really is directing the court.
What is the wording?
The wording in footnote 3 is that it's directing the court's attention to a Fifth Circuit case.
You want to read it, ma'am?
Yeah, I will certainly try to find that footnote.
Oh, come on. That had to be right by your side if you can. I can't imagine. Well, maybe you wanted to lose it.
Sorry. I'm not able to find it right now, but I certainly will be able to find it.
Wasn't the word bind in it or something?
The word bind was in it, but the wording in terms of binding was talking about the Fifth Circuit's holding in the In Re Chevron case. And so what we were saying there is that there were, in the Fifth Circuit, certain circumstances in which a test plaintiff situation could be binding. But that court actually, the Fifth Circuit, has actually taken a look at that case, the In Re Chevron case.
No, but that's not the relevant. If I were the district judge, I'm reading that footnote, I would think, oh, this is one of the advantages of moving ahead with the test plaintiffs.
But we were not stating that it was one of the advantages of the way we were moving forward. We were not suggesting that there be a selection process that was representative of all of the claims in this case. And so what we were doing was really distinguishing from the circumstances in which there is a question as to whether it could be binding. If you look at everything around that footnote, and I think that's really important here to look at the amalgam of the record and the context, you can't take one footnote out of place to then say that bound thousands of plaintiffs. That's not a consent or an agreement to be bound, and I think it's dangerous to do that because we're talking about constitutional
rights
here.
What about the failure to bring a 59 motion afterwards?
Yes, DynCorp certainly makes a big deal about this. You know, there are no cases.
Well, they've got a D.C. Circuit case that says just what they say, Jones.
Well, in fact, what DynCorp did is they cited cases in which there was a post-judgment motion filed, which is very different from saying that there's a requirement that a post-judgment motion be actually filed.
Go ahead.
I don't think that's true in Jones.
Yeah.
I think in Jones, there was no post-judgment motion filed at all.
Well, I think that certainly one of the issues in terms of doing that is often when there, or in those instances where there has been some requirement that a post-judgment motion of some kind be filed, it's because, in fact, there was perhaps a situation where subsequent proceedings had taken place at the district court level, and the opportunity to raise those issues with the district
court
was presented. I don't think that happened in Jones, but it did happen in the supplemental authority that they had filed.
No, but I'm just asking, Judge Sullivan and I are just asking about Jones, which seems to be, it says that, I mean, you say in your brief that this just stands for the unremarkable proposition that issues have to be raised in the district court before they can be raised here. But in Jones, Jones presents no compelling reason why he could not have raised this argument either in a motion for reconsideration or to vacate and set aside under Rule 59.
I think the issue there, though, was, again, having that opportunity to otherwise present that issue with the district court. Here,
was present in Jones that's not present here?
I'm sorry.
What opportunity are you saying was present in Jones that is not present here?
Right. Well, what I'm saying is that there, here, the only option, really, when we were concluded, was to, in fact, file an appeal.
What opportunity was present in Jones that is not present here?
Your Honor, I would have to go back and review that and be able to answer that question.
You don't tender that as a distinction, then?
In this moment, I do not, but certainly on rebuttal, I will be able to clarify that if that is what the court is interested in.
But why would, I'm just curious from a litigation strategy point of view, when, I mean, you feel pretty strongly that the district court got this wrong, and you cite many aspects of his own order, which indicates that even he didn't think it was binding. Why, when he issued the summary judgment motion against the non-test plaintiffs, didn't you ask him to correct it?
Well, again, because he issued, from our perspective, he issued a final and appealable order that appeared to be clearly applying to all of the plaintiffs. That was error, and we don't believe that there is
any... You didn't want to correct his error, huh?
I'm sorry?
You do not want to correct his error.
It's not that we didn't want to request...
You want to seize the opportunity to go upstairs.
There were two issues, though. One is that often when you file a motion for clarification on one issue, if that issue is resolved, it will completely resolve the issues and the case can otherwise proceed before the district court. Here we have five issues that are on appeal. So even if he had clarified that the motions for summary judgment did not apply or the dispositions of the summary judgment did not apply to the non-test plaintiffs, there still would have been other issues.
But this is by far and away the most important issue, isn't it?
Well, I would say it is a very important issue.
Well, you treated it as the most important issue in your brief.
We've given and dedicated a significant amount of briefing space to it, but there certainly were other issues that we spent more than half of our
briefing. So would it have been better off to get rid of this issue from a point of view? I'm following up on Judge Tatel's question. I don't understand the tactical decision here. If you could have prevailed on this one, you would have reduced your exposure of going to the Court of Appeals much more. As a matter of fact, if you had prevailed in the district court, what would the district judge's order look like?
If we had prevailed at the district court
on this issue,
we would have been left with other rulings that would have applied.
Well, now, wait a minute. Yeah, but would you even have a right to appeal the other rulings?
I think we would have had a right
to. I'm not sure. It wouldn't have been a final judgment then.
Well, it would have been a final, certain aspects would have been a final judgment, certainly as to the
I'm not sure.
The test point.
As to the
it
test,
would have been final.
As to the test point,
that's
yes.
Right.
And so we would have had that opportunity. So I think that we would have assessed holistically at the time, certainly, in terms of what was left. But again, here we felt that there were other issues that needed to go up on appeal.
Well, normally, we don't take up issues on appeal that haven't been presented to the district. Has this, in some fashion, been presented to the district court?
In terms of the non-test plaintiff issue, I think that it was presented to the district court in that when you look at the history of the case, certainly, there was a very clear decision, and it seemed
That would tend to support your argument that the district court erred, but does it support the proposition that you gave the district court a chance to pass on?
Well, I think that it was presented to the district court in the sense that he very clearly, after ruling on the summary judgment motions, entered judgment against all plaintiffs in this case.
Yeah, he did that, right? And you're saying that's error. And you're saying it's error in part because the non-test plaintiffs were not bound. But did you then say to the district court, but, Your Honor, the non-test plaintiffs are not bound?
In the form of a post-judgment motion of some kind, no, we did not.
In any form, did you do that after the entry?
We did not seek clarification afterwards.
And I'm back to Judge Tatel's question, and followed up on also by Judge Silverman, is as a matter of litigation strategy, wouldn't it have been a lot simpler to have preserved that issue by making the motion?
Well, again, I think it would have been a different strategy. I'm not sure that it would have been necessarily simpler. It would have been a different strategy, and I don't think that that necessarily, it certainly does not preclude this court from ruling on what are very important issues when, again, it is generally very disfavored to file motions for clarification, motions for consideration, et cetera, on issues that have been decided.
Motions for reconsideration can only be made on issues decided.
Yes, but for the purposes of finality, to move the case along and to then present those issues for appeal.
Can I ask you about the standing issue about the three provinces? I don't understand why standing is an issue in a tort case like this. Isn't the simple question whether or not the provinces have been can show injury and whether it was caused by the defendant? Isn't that the way tort cases either win or lose on that? Do you know of tort cases where plaintiffs lose for lack of standing?
I think that it certainly... I'm sorry?
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I think that here we are still required to show that there is Article III standing for these three provinces.
Well, but if you can't show causation, the defendant says you even if you've shown injury, the three can't show causation. Because there's no evidence in the record that this was caused by the defendant. Doesn't that just mean you lose on the merits?
No, I don't think so. And I think that's a melding and a conflating of two different standards. I think when we talk about causation, and the defendants have talked about that, they're really focusing much more on approximate cause standard, when in fact the appropriate standard is whether the injuries were fairly traceable to the defendant's conduct. And in this case,
fairly traceable and causation are almost exactly the same concepts. There are very few cases where it's different.
Well, but I think the Supreme Court has certainly made a distinction between that, and we cited that in our our Lexmark case. I'm sorry?
Well, what in these interrogatory answers, that's what you're relying on, what links the alleged injury suffered by the three provinces to the actions of the defendant? I'll tell you that... To the extent they both talk about Colombia refugees fleeing to Ecuador, massive presence of Colombian citizens fleeing. What connects the injury to the provinces to that?
Part, it's important to make this distinction between the injuries that the provinces suffered versus the injuries that the plaintiffs and individuals have actually suffered. So the province suffered actual expenditures, not future expenditures, but actual expenditures on things like healthcare, education, precisely because of the fleeing that you're talking about, not only of Colombian citizens, but also of Ecuadorians. That is, when communities were hit hard by the spraying, various people, many, many people, refugees, as you point out, fled, and when they did, they fled into neighboring communities and neighboring provinces. That caused them to have an increased expenditures, both in healthcare as a result of people who were coming into their system who had been damaged in some way, but also in terms of things like education and things of that sort. So this is all proprietary interests and demonstrate injuries, in fact, and also injuries that were fairly traceable to the conduct of the defendants in this case. Okay, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
And during the reserve period, find that footnote for us, please.
Okay.
Good
Your Honors, Eric Lasker on behalf of the appellee DynCorp International. The key issue in this case, as raised by the plaintiffs, is whether Judge Roberts committed reversible error under Rule 56F when he extended his summary judgment ruling to the non-test plaintiffs.
You made the motion only on behalf of the test plaintiff. I mean, only on behalf of your client against the test plaintiff, right?
That's exactly correct, Your Honor, because as we understood the procedure, as set forth in the March 2009 submission, we would move on the test plaintiffs, and then depending on the nature of the ruling, if it's a general causation ruling, we expect it to be extended to the entire case. But the issue under Rule 56F, there's at least three issues that plaintiffs have to overcome before you even get to the issue of the footnote. The first part, as all of Your Honors noted, is that there's an obligation to raise the issue with the district court before you bring it up on appeal. And that's specifically important in the context of 56F, because that's going to be a motion that by its nature is going to resolve the litigation.
Well, you're not arguing that this issue wasn't properly before the court before the court ruled on the summary judgment issue, right? I mean, it had been briefed, correct?
The summary judgment issue had been briefed, yes.
So your argument is that it should have been raised in a post-judgment motion?
Yes, Your Honor. As you noted in Jones versus Horn.
Yeah. Are there any other cases that... So is it your view that the law, any issue not raised, even if an issue is raised before judgment, that if the plaintiff loses, he or she has to bring it up in a post-judgment motion?
No, Your Honor. The situation here is the issue is not raised before judgment.
I thought you just said you agreed with me that prior to his ruling, this question was briefed, wasn't it?
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I misunderstood your question. The issue of whether or not the plaintiffs have presented causation evidence, general causation evidence, have been briefed.
No. I'm not talking about causation. I'm talking about whether or not this would be binding on non-test plaintiffs.
Your Honor, the issue of whether the ruling is binding is not the 56F test. That is certainly...
That's what you're being asked about.
Okay,
that's
I'm sorry.
That's the question of whether it's binding on the non-test plaintiffs. Was it briefed before?
Certainly, the plaintiffs in their March 2009 submission stated it would be binding, yes. There wasn't an issue of did the district court then error in extending his ruling, as they argue under Rule 56F, to the non-test plaintiffs.
No, but Judge Tatel's question is, did both parties ever brief the question, besides the footnote, whether a ruling on the test plaintiffs would bind the non-test plaintiffs, other than the footnote?
I'm sorry, no, Your Honor. It was not briefed before that.
Well, but in the text of their, what is this, let's see. So it was on March 23 that the plaintiffs submitted their proposal, right?
For the selection of the test plaintiffs, yes.
Yeah, and there's language in here which they point to which suggests that they did not think, except for the footnote, that it would be binding. The only way in which useful information is to be obtained is if their claims are both representative, etc., to give shape and measure to the ultimate questions. And they say the purpose of using samples is to get a good representation so that the first trial will allow parties to assess the situation, get an accurate picture of what the jury will do. I mean, bellwethers would form a useful foundation for settlement or other resolution of the balance of the cases. So they're telling the district court that they think this is not binding.
Well, Your Honor, I would, on that point, ask what other resolutions there could be. It'd be settlement or other resolution. The only other resolution there could be would be a ruling that would be dispositive as to the entire case.
No. But again, isn't the distinction between you either, there's two kinds of bellwether trials, right? There's one that's binding on all plaintiffs, and the other, you just try a few of them, see how they come out, and that affects, you know, how the parties deal with the rest. Do they settle? Don't they? What do they do with them? Right? Those are the two options here.
Yes, Your Honor, if a case proceeds to trial, but even in the plaintiff's original Rule 16.3 statement before they were, when they're saying we wouldn't have a bellwether approach, they acknowledged, and it's in their Rule 16.3 statement at App 159, that dispositive issues applicable to the entire population certainly could be ruled on in a fresh trial.
Don't tell us what the gist of it is. Read that statement to us.
That was a statement. I'm sorry. The statement in their Rule 16.3 statement was that a bellwether trial could resolve dispositive issues applicable to the entire population. And that's the second issue,
that's
Your Honor.
That's the period after that, right?
I believe so,
that's
yes, Your
Honor. Right. Okay.
And that brings us to the second issue under Rule 56F, Your Honor, which is even if there was an error...
Don't go to the second issue.
Sorry.
Don't go to the second issue.
I'm sorry.
I want to make sure that I understand your position. So your view is that this was not raised at all prior to judgment, correct?
There was no briefing on the issue, no.
Your argument is that the plaintiff's argument is forfeited because he did not raise the issue prior to judgment. Is that your position?
No, our position is it's waived because they didn't raise it after the ruling.
Okay, that's what I thought your position was.
I'm sorry.
Okay,
we can talk about Jones. Position. It's a combined position. You argued first that the footnote misled the district judge or caused an estoppel, and then the issue was never raised beyond that before the district judge.
I would agree with that, Your Honor, although I didn't understand that to be the point Judge Tatel was reading. There is estoppel here. And particularly also it goes to the issue of notice, which is the issue under Rule 56F.
I just want you to focus in. We've now got an agreement here. You acknowledge that your argument is they should have filed a post-judgment motion, correct?
Yes.
And you cite Jones.
Yes.
So I take it then your position is that that in all circumstances, plaintiffs appealing must, even if they raise the issue pre-judgment, if they lose, they have to raise it post-judgment in order to raise it on appeal.
No, Your Honor, because the specific issue that they're appealing on is whether or not the district court erred when he extended his ruling on the test plaintiffs to the non-test plaintiffs. That issue hadn't been raised before his ruling. His ruling presented that issue. And I think Judge Silverman had it correct when he surmised, and we believe as well, that the reason that the plaintiffs did not address that issue in post-trial briefing is they didn't want to give the district court an opportunity to cure any error or explain any error if, in fact, error had been made.
Do you need estoppel to win this issue?
No, Your Honors, we don't. Because, again, the first issue is whether or not they raised it below. The second is the standard of review. The standard of review is harmless error. And there's no question here that the district court's ruling on general causation was a ruling that would govern all of the plaintiffs in this case.
If there is an error on this point, the error was made in extending summary judgment to the non-test plaintiffs. Now, there was not occasion for that issue to be raised before the judge had committed that alleged error, was it? If they were going to raise it at all,
no,
they had to raise it post.
They had to raise it post. And under Rule 56F, of course, that's going to be the issue that will always be before the court. I mean, Rule 56F is a new rule in the federal rules enacted in 2010. And the very nature of a Rule 56F is it's a summary judgment ruling on the court's initiative. And so it's going to be a final ruling. And the very nature of it is that the party who was ruled against may have concerns about the fact that this ruling was extended. If the rule is not that they have to raise the issue with the district court first, then all these issues are going to go straight up to the Court of Appeals, and the parties are going to have a strategic reason not to raise the issue because they don't want to give the district court an opportunity.
May I go on to a couple of other questions?
Sure.
What about Judge Tatel's questions about standing? What do you think about his supposition that in a tort case, standing is not relevant? I'm not sure that's correct, but what do you think?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it's correct. Standing is always relevant. And the key issue here, of course, and what confuses the analysis, is that this is a case brought by state actors, in this case foreign state actors. And it is in the nature of what the Supreme Court has recognized as a classic parents patriae case.
But they don't claim to be suing in that capacity. They're suing to recover their own damages.
Economic injuries.
Yeah, economic injuries to them.
Well, I understand.
In fact, see, that's how I think this thing got talked into standing, because the briefs in the district court, your brief suggests you're just suing parents patriae, and you argue standing, and that makes an enormous amount of sense, but that isn't what they're claiming.
Well, actually, Your Honor, in the complaint, they did allege that they're suing parents patriae.
Yeah, but they're also claiming damage to their own budget.
They are, Your Honor, but if the rule was that a government actor can claim standing because impacts on individuals give rise to expenses in the budget, then that pretty much that consumes the parents patriae doctrine. Any case, then, any serial litigation, any mass tort now can be brought by a state in addition to the individual plaintiffs. We have
Suppose there was direct, clear, uncontroverted evidence that it cost them $100 million in additional health care. Are you saying they wouldn't have standing?
If they were a U.S. state under parents patriae...
I'm not talking about parents patriae. I'm just talking about...
It's not even clear that parents patriae works for a U.S. state.
In
Massachusetts versus EPA, Justice Stevens' opinion seemed to avoid resting on parents patriae, although he discussed it.
I agree with that, and I think, Your Honor, the issue, and it's raised in Pennsylvania versus CLEP, it's raised in Hawaii versus Standard Oil, is if a state can say we were directly injured because of an impact on our budget, well, that's how governments act. When their citizens are impacted by cross-border contamination, which is the situation in most of the original parents patriae cases the Supreme Court talked about, in our current government system...
In other words, your argument is causation is completely speculative.
Well, definitely in this case.
That is your argument.
That is the argument. And also, Your Honor, I mean, there are narco-terrorists in the area. I mean, there was a war going on in this area. There is no showing to connect anything that the provinces alleged to the Plan Columbia spraying. So there clearly was, as the district court recognized, no showing that beyond speculation to link anything that's going on to the spraying operations.
Other question I have for you. I didn't find your answer to the battery issue very persuasive. If I'm a farmer standing on a field and spray comes down upon my field in my head, haven't I suffered a battery?
Your Honor, it would be under D.C. law potentially a battery for which you could get nominal injuries. But the key point
here... That's all right. That's still a battery, isn't it? The district court can throw it out because it's only nominal injuries?
Well, the key point here, Your Honor, is that in this issue, the plaintiffs did not raise this in opposition to the summary judgment motion they're appealing.
I'm sorry?
The plaintiffs did not raise that argument in response to the summary judgment motion that they're appealing. We move for summary judgment on all of their claims based upon a lack of causation evidence. In response to that summary judgment motion, they did not raise any of the arguments that they're raising in their brief. Now, we did have separate issues that we had raised below, but those weren't ruled on. Our motion for summary judgment on lack of expert evidence was for full summary judgment, if you look at our motion, and the plaintiffs didn't raise any of these arguments in opposition.
But weren't they raised in the simultaneously filed opposition to the other motion for summary judgment?
Some of the arguments were raised, but that motion was specifically a separate motion on if they were to survive the motion on lack of expert causation. The motion we filed for summary judgment because they failed to provide expert causation was entire unto itself. If we prevailed on that motion, our request was that the entire case be thrown out. And the plaintiffs did not raise in their opposition to that the argument, but Your Honors, we have other parts of these claims that do not require expert causation. Now, we had a separate motion that would be cleaning up issues if we did not prevail on that first motion, but we did prevail on that first motion, which is why the district court held that the separate motion was moot. If they want to make those arguments, they need to make them in response to the summary judgment motion that we prevailed upon.
Let me take you back to the issue about the binding effect on the setting aside the footnote for a minute. What's your reaction to the language that the plaintiffs point to elsewhere in the district court's decision, which they say indicates that he didn't think it was binding? For example, at one point he's worried in his order about the plaintiffs, they might pick their weakest cases, and he says it may only sort of prolong things before both sides get a full opportunity to see how the weak cases play out and what impact they may eventually have on any theoretical settlement discussions in the future. And then in another, so they cite that, which suggests the district court thinks once these trials are over, there will be settlement talks. And then in another one, the district court says in another order, I should probably take a moment to make clear what the aim has been in structuring where we are. The aim has been to identify a test group of plaintiffs for trial if they have to go to trial without being settled first. And then once the results are in, allow those results to inform the future direction of settlement talks.
Well, yes, Your Honor.
So what about all that language that's in there?
I would submit most of the language that's in there is from prior to the March 2009 ruling. And in fact, the language Your Honor quoted...
I was quoting from the ruling. That's the ruling I'm quoting for.
I'm sorry. There was language in his hearing where he said if both parties select cases, that may not get us to where we want
to
get.
That's not what I quoted for you.
Okay. Well,
I was quoting from the order.
Let me step back in any event, Your Honor. I think there's an important point here to be made, which is while we certainly believe that the plaintiff's agreement to be bound sort of answers any debate here, the issue under Rule 56F is notice and opportunity. And in the November 2008 hearing, Judge Roberts made very clear that he had an issue, a concern in this case about causation, and he asked the plaintiffs point blank, and this is before selection of test plaintiffs, how do you expect to survive summary judgment on causation? That's at at App 30102. And he also stated that his expectation was that the parties would proceed, the defendants would file summary judgment motions, and then the case would proceed to trial if there was a trial to be had with respect to some test plaintiffs. And the issue of causation and the issue of the need for expert testimony was a constant theme. Every time the plaintiffs appeared in court, from the very first hearing in November 2007, Judge Roberts was telling the plaintiffs, where is your proof? How are you going to establish this? Where are your experts and who are your experts? And they had this, they were aware of this and had notice of this throughout, that this is what Judge Roberts was expecting.
I don't think you're responding to Judge Taylor.
I'm sorry.
What kind of that is the causation, which is what he was asking you. I mean, binding nature, which is what he was asking you about.
Your Honor,
can you hurry up and get to that?
I'm sorry. I believe under the March 2009, that footnote, there's no explanation for it other than what it says.
You don't have any response to the language I quoted to you then. I should ignore that?
Well, no, Your Honor. I think that language points out the reason why it is so important for the plaintiffs to raise the issue in a post-trial motion.
Wait a minute. As I read the order, setting aside the footnote in the motion, okay. The order says the judge, this is the way the plaintiffs interpret it, yeah. The judge viewed his summary judgment order as setting up bellwether trials, so that they could provide a basis for future settlement talks in the non-bellwether cases. Now, if that's what's in his order, what difference does anything else make?
Your Honor, I would submit that his order was not committing that there would be future trials. It was stating, depending on how those trials are resolved.
Why would he talk about future settlement talks if this was to be binding on all plaintiffs?
If the case went to trial, Your Honor, I can't imagine a ruling that would have been dispositive to the entire case.
I guess your argument has to be he's assuming the possibility that the test plaintiffs would win, in which case there might be settlement discussions. Has to be your argument. But, of course, Judge Tatel's response would be, well, they could either win or lose.
Right. Respectfully, no, Your Honor. If it went to trial, win or lose, I don't think then you'd have a situation where you'd have a ruling that would be binding.
If the test plaintiffs bound the other plaintiffs, and they lost, why would there be settlement discussions?
It would depend on the nature.
Appeal, appeal is the only possibility.
This is an important point, Your Honor. It would depend on the nature of the ruling. If there is a trial verdict and a finding by the jury that is individualized and specific to those plaintiffs, that they individually had problems that prevented them from proving their case, statute of limitations or something individual to them, not our position that that would be binding on
counsel,
the rest of the...
Counsel, are you asserting that a summary judgment decides more than a trial would decide?
My understanding
of summary judgment is always when you've got the same issue, you're just deciding that there's no material issue, substantial issue of material fact as to one of those issues. But the judgment would be the same in either case, would it not?
It would depend upon, Your Honor, respectfully, the nature of the holding. If there's a holding that is generally applicable, that there is no general causation evidence, then that is a separate thing than individual test plaintiffs not proving their individual cases. And I would submit, and looking again back at the November 2008 hearing and all the proceedings in front of the court, that the issue of general causation, whether the plaintiffs would be able to establish generally that any injury had taken place, was an issue that would be dispositive for the entire case. And this is much different than, for example, in Three Mile Island, where the non-trial plaintiffs had a different theory of causation. And in fact, in that case, the Third Circuit held that the non-trial plaintiffs couldn't come back with the exact same causation theory. If you look at
opinion... Do I hear you saying none of the past 20 minutes makes any difference because any judgment against the test plaintiffs is automatically binding on all plaintiffs? Is that what you're saying?
To the extent that there is a ruling that is generally applicable, the district court has the discretion under Rule 56F to extend that ruling.
With and, notice?
Well, Your Honor, with notice, but also before you get...
56F specifically says with notice.
I definitely agree with that, Your
There's
Honor.
There's no notice here, is there?
Well, we believe that there is, but Your Honor, again...
Show me the notice. What
okay.
is the notice?
In November, in, the November, in the November 2008 hearing...
Wait 1 minute.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Let us finish questions.
I'm sorry.
What is the notice that you say the non-test plaintiffs had before the entry of the summary judgment against them?
In the November 2008 hearing, the district court asked them at App 301 to 302 how they expected to survive summary judgment on causation. This is before selection of test plaintiffs.
This is before even the selection of the test plaintiffs.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Before the making of the summary judgment motion.
Yes,
how
sir.
How can you possibly say that that's notice that he's going to extend the ruling in the summary judgment motion beyond the motion that was made? The motion hadn't been made yet then.
Well, Your Honor, it is noticing because the district court is allowing the plaintiffs to understand that a causation ruling the district court views as being an issue that could resolve the entire case. Because the district court also states that after the summary judgment rulings, they would then decide if some trial for test plaintiffs has to be conducted. And again, Your Honors, under 56F...
For test plaintiffs, but you still... He extended the summary judgment motion was made as against the test plaintiffs, right?
Yes, sir.
You said that when we started this discussion.
Yes.
Now, after that point, he extended the ruling to the non-test plaintiffs when he entered the judgment, right?
Well, it was actually in the same ruling, but yes.
When he made the ruling, it would be the same ruling, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Where was there notice to the non-test plaintiffs that he was going to do that?
And, Your Honors, for there to be notice in that sitting situation, the notice would have been in the proceedings leading up to
after
over the past
notice,
4 years.
You're relying on 56F.
Yes.
After giving notice and a reasonable time to respond, the court may, and then it goes on to say about granting for a non-movement or granting on grounds not laid or granting on its own after the part of the material fact. But it's always everything under 56F, which is what you're relying on, says after giving notice and a reasonable time to respond.
That is
and
correct.
Now, that's what I'm looking for from you now, is where was that notice and reasonable time to respond? If you're relying on 56F, you should have thought of that.
Well,
what is your answer to that question?
Your Honor, again, the notice came before the motions were filed.
How can you give notice that he's going to extend the motion before the motion's made?
If the issue is whether a general causation ruling could have general applicability.
What's it got to do with general causation? The only question, it's devoid of what, it makes no difference what the issue is. Judge Santel's asking you about the motion itself. It makes no difference what it's about, right?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that for the court, if the court is letting the plaintiffs know leading up to, through the entire proceedings, how he's viewing how this would go and what they need to establish on general causation to be able to proceed with any of their claims, that is putting them on notice of what would happen if they...
Let me go back to my earlier question.
Yes.
None of the past now 30 minutes is relevant because your theory is since the issue with general causation, that is automatically binding on all plaintiffs whether they consent or not.
Well,
isn't that your point?
Your Honor, to the extent that I agree that whether or not the plaintiffs agreed. I'm sorry.
I don't remember seeing that argument in your brief.
Well, Your Honor.
I thought your brief was all turned on the fact that the plaintiffs consented.
In our opposition brief at page 41, Your Honor, we talk about the fact that unless there is prejudice, if the ruling is going to extend to the entire case, it's a harmless error standard. And therefore, again, under the standard review here for the court, you need to find that there's some other argument that the non-test plaintiffs had that would not have been subsumed within the general causation argument. Otherwise, it's harmless error. So we raise that on our brief in page 41. And again, Your Honor, circling back to the threshold issue here, which is all of these questions and the parsing of the district court language is we're in this situation because the plaintiff appellants decided they did not want to raise this issue with the district court, as this court held in Jones v. Horn, they're obligated to do, so that you're not in this situation where we're trying to parse language and debate what the district court had in mind. If the plaintiffs had proceeded...
Well, but in Jones, the court emphasized that that was especially important where there were fact issues. And here there aren't. This is summary judgment. We're looking at the record de novo.
The fact issue in Jones v. Horn was whether or not the plaintiff had received a copy of the motion to dismiss, specifically whether he had noticed that he was facing the issue his claim could be dismissed. So it's actually the same fact issue in that case as there is in this case, Your Honor. And the plaintiffs made the strategic decision that if they raised this issue with Judge Roberts, he might issue a ruling that would take this out of the case, and they decided not to do that. Now, that is the very reason why this court has the rules in place that it has, that issues have to be raised in the district court, or else they're waived. The plaintiffs made a strategic decision not to do that.
Do you
have
any case other than Jones that says that?
Well, Your Honor, we believe Numerium
supports that. Numerium, the issue was not raised ever, not even before judgment.
That is
correct.
Well, the issue of whether or not the non-bank accounts were part of this was they argued it had been raised before. The plaintiffs argued that they raised in their statement of facts in that case. But in the Spring Street case, the issue was not raised before as to whether or not, in that case, as Your Honors will recall, there were three defendants who were added to the case after the summary judgment briefing had been filed. The issue of whether it would extend, the ruling would extend to them was not raised before the court issued its ruling. The court issued its ruling, and then the defendants in that case didn't raise the issue post judgment, and the court held they waived it because they had not raised it.
Explain to me, I'm a little uncertain exactly procedurally what would have happened if the district judge had limited his ruling to the test plaintiffs, leaving open. Suppose a Rule 59 motion had come in and said, Your Honor, your ruling should have been limited to the test plaintiffs and should not extend to the non-test plaintiffs. And he said, oh, you know, you're right about that. I was misled and I made a mistake there, so I'm modifying my ruling. Then what would have happened procedurally? Would the test plaintiffs go up on appeal or would have been held? Or how would that have been handled?
Well, Your Honor, the first thing we would have done is filed a notice of a motion to show cause why the ruling should not extend to all of the
non-test plaintiffs. No, so you lose on that one. Then I'm just trying to figure out procedurally, would half the case have come up to us? Would the test plaintiffs come up or would it have been delayed waiting? I'm trying to figure out exactly what would have happened.
I believe they would have needed to move for an interlocutory appeal at that instance.
You think it would have had to have been an interlocutory appeal? They couldn't have appealed directly up on the half the case.
I'm not sure the answer to that question. There were other issues also, Your Honor, as noted in the brief, that would be dispositive of the entire claim. There were five other summary judgment motions filed, and some of them were, it's undisputed by the plaintiffs, would cover the entire case. But
that doesn't quite answer my question.
Yeah, but I believe it would have been an interlocutory appeal. Now, it may have been granted in that instance.
No. The question is whether it would have had to have been an interlocutory appeal. It's interesting how to figure out how that would have worked, because your counsel on the other side seemed to suggest the contrary. But we'll sit down. We'll hear from her.
Thank you.
I just have one question for you, and I want to take you back to the very first question Judge Sentell asked you, which is about your own motion for summary judgment.
Yes.
Let me read you the last sentence. for reasons stated herein, defendant's motion for summary judgment should be granted, and all of the test plaintiff's claims should be dismissed.
That is correct,
Your Honor. That's all you asked for.
That is correct, Your Honor. The motion on, for summary judgment, first of all, dealt with both specific and general causation. And we were also following the procedures
as
we
understood. It says, and all of test plaintiff's claims. If you had thought at that time that these were either binding because the plaintiffs were agreed to it or because your theory of general causation had an effect on everybody, it would have said, and all of the plaintiff's claims dismissed.
Our anticipation, Your Honor, was that we would, if we prevailed, file a motion to show cause to extend the ruling to all of the non-test plaintiffs. That was what we anticipated doing as the second step. Mm-hmm. We were following the procedures we understood that had been set forth, and all certainly right. The ruling would okay. be binding and all, but we'd have to file another motion.
Okay. We'll look here. Does Ms. Collins have any time left? Okay. You can take 2 minutes. You have a big footnote to talk about, so...
Okay, so obviously addressing this footnote 3, which is on appendix page 411, it is important to also look at the context and what was before there. Sure. It's, and I'll read just the sentence that's before it, to which it's attached. Other approaches, part of the cases selected by defendants or all of the cases selected by random sampling, have profound drawbacks. Then there's footnote 3. It says, CEG in Re Chevron USA, the rest of the site, selection process of 15 cases proposed by each of two sides was lacking in, quote, representativeness. As such, although the selections might facilitate settlement, no binding effect could be given to the outcome for the remaining claims. All that was resolved was 30 claims. The process could not foster a global resolution of the remaining 2,970 claims there. All we're saying in this discussion is we are talking about...
All you're saying is that there's advantage in the plaintiff picking the test plaintiffs because then it would bind the whole case.
That isn't what we're saying. We're not saying the advantage...
Gee, that's what I would have read it as a district judge.
Well, that's why I'm saying that what you need to do is... And the district judge, I think, did actually look at the entirety of our papers because what we say before that was that... We are looking at a representative to form a meaningful foundation for settlement or other resolution in some way, but we're not saying that it was binding, and the district court didn't interpret it as being binding because it later ruled on our motion for clarification that there could, in fact, be settlements afterwards, and we would have a first round and then a second round. So we don't even have to read tea leaves in terms of what the district court thought. The district court was clear about what it thought.
Wait a minute. The district court granted summary judgment for all plaintiffs. So obviously the district judge thought he could do so.
Well, there was certainly at some point there was a breakdown in the process, but in terms of whether we intended for it to be binding or not, that was clear, I think, in his order that was responding to our motion for clarification on this issue of selecting the test plaintiffs.
What do you think happened here? I mean, your theory is that when he approved this process, he thought it would only be, they wouldn't be binding, right? That's your theory, that the district court did not intend these bellwether trials to be binding. So what happened between then and the grant of summary judgment that led him to grant summary judgment with respect to all the plaintiffs?
Well,
what do you think happened?
You know, I mean, I think it's hard to speculate.
Did
in
you
terms
try?
Of,
were you, did you do this? Were you involved in these proceedings in the district court?
Not in the district.
Oh.
Not in the district court. In some of the summary judgment opposition, oh. but not at the at this stage initially, uh-huh. With selecting the bellwethers, or
well,
the.
Well, what led to the confusion that you say occurred here?
I'm sorry?
What led to the confusion?
You know, I don't think any one of us can really know what led specifically to the district court's confusion here. I think that he reviewed the summary judgment motions. It was quite clear that the defendants had only moved on the test plaintiffs and not on the non-test plaintiffs. And for whatever reason, he determined that that could, in fact, be extended. I can only suggest that he committed the same error that other district courts have committed, like in the In Re TMI case or in the Dodge case or even in some other cases in which he believed that if he was ruling that a lack of an expert could be applied to everyone and that was needed for all plaintiffs, that he was able to do that without providing adequate notice. And I say that because other district courts have made that error and they've been reversed. In Re TMI was an example of that, where the Third Circuit said that is not good enough.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Case is submitted. Please call the next.